Hello. Hello. Mrs. Weiss, please.
Yes, hold on a moment. She's gone, but she'll be calling in or coming in to pick something up and we can give her a message.
Excuse me, I'm not sure where I will be. I will try to reach her later this evening.
Okay.
Thank you.
Righto. Bye-bye.
Back, and I was wondering if there's anything that we might discuss or anything that we might be able to follow up on that could help you or vice versa on in accomplishing this mission and kind of what the attitude was. I just got back from over there about a month ago
uh-huh.
from my last visit, and I just thought I had not seen anything in the paper that spelled out anything in detail, and I thought I would
yeah.
give you a call.
Well, I didn't have any news conference after I got back.
Which is probably wise,
and,
if you had any success at all.
Well, I won't know yet. Just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I'm supposed to bring a green zipper folder out of my back seat of the car, and I had some stuff in there that I need to use on this call. Well, this one in the trunk is in the back seat. Well, I had a meeting for about an hour and 40 minutes with them.
Now, that's with the North Vietnamese and
yeah.
not the Viet Cong.
Right.
And was that at number 2 Le Verrier, or was that at their compound?
I was at their compound.
Mm-hmm.
And I met with V.
Mm-hmm. Minh V.
Yeah.
He's their number 2. He's the man that was in charge when Xuan Thuy was still in Hanoi.
Right.
Right.
And... Of course, in order to get in, I told him that I wanted to talk about peace in Southeast Asia. They told me beforehand that
right.
he wouldn't see me if I wanted to talk about the POWs.
Right, right.
So I got in there, and I just gave him a little of my background, and I was raised up there at Pamp on the ranch, and,
mm-hmm.
and trying to build a little psychological thing that I was, you know, a farmer and all this sort of business.
Right.
And, then we went on, after I did that, I told him one thing that the Congress and the Senate was united upon. It was about the treatment of the prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
That there was no deviation in opinions on this. And
right.
that most American people were behind the president in his efforts and were united
mm-hmm.
in these efforts. And then I moved on into... prisoner of war thing that I wanted to talk to him about the treatment of the prisoner of war, the communications with them, and the 4 or 5 points of
mm-hmm.
the Geneva
mm-hmm.
Convention. And then he said, we talked to Zion about this 2 or 3 weeks ago. He said, I'm not going to talk about that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He said, why did you come here if that's what you want to talk about?
Mm-hmm.
So then I kind of got off of that. Well, first of all, I said, why do you communicate with these pacifists in our country? I said, first of all, in the eyes of the people, you're dealing with people that are outcasts from our society that have no influence at all with our people.
Mm-hmm.
I said, why don't you
deal with somebody that speaks more
right.
for the majorities?
Right. Somebody that in authority. Mm-hmm. But he never would reply to that. And then I said, if you're treating these prisoners humanly and so forth and getting the treatment and everything, I said, why don't you let me go to Hanoi and see for myself, and then I'll come back, and if it's that way, I'll tell the people.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, will you provide me with safe conduct to Washington?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I think I can do that. I said, would you go if I could? And if you could, would you allow me to go to Hanoi?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you see, about Washington, he never would make any deal with me to go to Hanoi, see?
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't talked to anybody up here yet. Of course, Ambassador would have kind of chuckled at it, but I still think if it could be worked, you never know what might come out of it, to just bring him over here with no publicity at all.
That's right.
And escort him around and get acquainted with him. And I said, you think the American people aren't behind this war? I said, I'll be glad to take you out of my community and let you talk with any man on the street about it. And,
Did he say anything at all, Congressman, that might lead you to believe that they are about to release any more men? Or did he keep saying over and over, as they've told us so many times, that settle the war and the prisoner of war issue won't be a problem?
Well,
withdraw the men and so forth and so on.
Yeah, they just kept going. Anytime they press them, just kept going back that we are the aggressor, and next
right.
one, total victory.
Right.
And they just repeat that over and over again. And then I said, well, you have troops in Laos and Cambodia enforcing your will upon these people, and why don't you, let's have a ceasefire and let's talk it over the table, and why don't you give at least some little minute indication that you're wanting peace, and you are the aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
We will never relent. You'll never make us quit. You bring your troops here, and you bomb our cities and kill our people. We don't do that to you in the United States. And I said, no, the only reason you don't is because you're not capable of it. And
mm-hmm. Did he bring out some pictures to show you bomb damage and all that?
He never showed me a picture of anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I just kept talking about things and then swinging back to the prisoner of war thing. And then I left him a list of five guys that I personally have flown with in my career,
mm-hmm.
three of which are prisoners and two are missing in action.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why don't you give us a list of those who are dead and just say if they're dead, let us know they're dead so their families will be relieved. And he said, well, how do I know where they are? And I said, well, you have ways of knowing where they are.
Mm-hmm.
I said, they're of no use to you anymore, the names of these dead people. And but I didn't get much satisfaction out of them.
Did he speak English, or did you have to use a translator?
No, I had an interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
And but when we left, I said, now, I'm coming back in November, and I would like to see you again in November. And he said, well, we will see. There's no use of us rehashing this whole thing, he said. He said, I've had it on the Nixon hard line, and you preach the same thing. You are the aggressor. And then I went back and told him, well, that my people that I represent feel that you are the aggressor and so forth. And then I said, who would you want to see in Washington if you came to Washington? And I asked him that three or four times. Finally, he said, I come to see you.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, when I left, I said, now I'm going to work on that. And if it can be done, well, I'll be back to see you.
Mm-hmm.
So I more or less kind of got an opening for to go back in the 15th of
November,
somewhere around in there. I think he would see me again, but I left him a list of these five guys, one of which is this Sam Johnson.
Right, from Plano.
Yeah, I flew with him in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
A boy named Raymond Merritt lives in California, and his wife, five kids, he's been there about as long as any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And a little boy named Fred Cherry, I was in cadets with, we roomed together, a color boy.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed Palmgren went down to 111 here just before the war stopped bombing up there.
Mm-hmm.
And another boy, George Jensen, that went down the early part of the war with Laos on a night mission,
mm-hmm.
C-47. They never knew anything more about that. So that's the list I left him. And
Was there a man there, a little guy with the name of Mr. Tam or Mr. Tom, that they called him, kind of short, younger, stocky type?
Well, there's a type
who,
of guy
who spoke
mine.
A little English?
Well, there was a guy similar to that that was my interpreter. There were just three of us, interpreter and...
Was the interpreter in the compound?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's Tom then. That's Mr. Tom. He was there when I took the first four wives over a year ago this month.
I had glasses on.
Right. Yeah, that's him. And he's been around. Speaks pretty good English.
Yeah, he does.
And he works as interpreter at both locations, their downtown location, plus that compound out there.
Yeah.
I mean, we found him at both locations.
Yeah.
Really. Well, there are reports, I don't know how true, that Cleaver's bunch was given a whole slew of letters.
Yeah, well, this is what I told him. I said, you give these people these letters, and I said, they have yet, to my knowledge, given them to the wives. In fact, they're trying to extort things from their wives.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I hit him, why don't you deal with legal people?
But he never wavered. He wanted to talk about peace. Primarily, and didn't want to get on the field
well,
anything.
He didn't even want to talk about that. He wanted to talk about their 10 points and
right.
For us to completely withdraw, and then they'd talk.
Mm-hmm.
And, but Ambassador Habib there told me that you don't know. He might not do a bit of good, or he might find out some information on it and mail it to me. He said, hell, you just can't tell.
Yeah, that depends on the mood they're in.
Yeah.
And they are ever-changing in their mood. What it takes to get the thing in the right direction, and that's a ceasefire.
Yeah.
Now, I'm surprised he didn't mention, he's always telling us, go back home and take part in the demo with the peace group. See Cora Weiss and see Rennie Davis and these people.
Well,
I'm sure he wouldn't say that to you because you are who you are.
Right, and I told him, you know, that they're a complete outcast. I said they're kooks of society and are considered so by the masses of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept telling me, you know, go back and convince American people they ought to get out of the war. And I said, well, I'm not coming back to do that because a major part of my people believe in what we're doing there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all quite interesting. Is there anything you think we can do that might help you that in the future on this thing?
Oh, I don't know. Habib said that to offer them money or medicine they considered a bribe. I did approach him on it. I said, my people in my district are willing to raise all kinds of medicine or anything of this nature which might be a benefit to your people
mm-hmm.
as an effort by the people, because this is what Ross had told my AA.
Right.
And so
they're
that's
talking
what
about people to people. They like to talk about that.
Yeah. And, but he didn't, you know...
Didn't bite for it?
No, he didn't. Give any indication on it.
Right.
Didn't seem to matter to him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think if you'd offered him $1 million or $10 million apiece for him, that it made a damn bit of difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I came away from the meeting, number one, feeling that I had an entree to him now.
Right.
And secondly, I sincerely believe they believe in what they believe.
I think that's true.
I
think
that's
they right.
Think we are the aggressor, and I think they feel that we did interfere, and that's just the way they feel.
Right. I think you're right, Congressman. I think that's... We at first had... We didn't... Maybe it was because we didn't want to believe this, but more recently, we think that they're very honest with this.
Well, that's I think there's no question about it. I think they just...
Are that way.
Are dedicated, and that's the way they believe. He says, you... have never met a Vietnamese or talked with Vietnamese before, have you? And I said, well, I've talked with a few Vietnamese when I was in Saigon a year or two ago, but first time I ever sit down and face-to-face talk with them.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Congressman, thank you so very much. If there's anything we can do to help you, let us hear from you.
All right, then I'll try to keep you posted on my efforts. I'm going to talk to somebody about the possibility of getting him over here.
Good. That's good. Ross was out of town today, and he told me to be sure and call and talk with you.
Right.
And we look forward to hearing from you, sir.
All right.
Thank you now.
Thanks for calling.
Surely.
Bye.
Bye.
been no change.
Yeah. Is this still as a result of from your first fee and first contact with him?
As far as I know, yeah. I mean, I haven't said anything else.
Yeah.
But I imagine if he's going to be flying around to Washington, there'll be additional fees, sure. I don't think the man's just going to fly down to Washington and not charge me for it.
Well, case in point, the thing that I'm interested in is the fact that are you sure that you need him in this capacity? Because I'm not sure after your conversation with me that you're going to need him in that capacity.
See, we don't know. We don't know what they're going to do. As
well, that's the thing I don't understand. You're spending this money and so forth and going to these efforts when you don't know.
Well, that's just it. You know, originally before we contacted their office, you know, they were telling us, well, you might be charged with desertion and whatnot, you know, because you went to Sweden. And, you know, which kind of got us a little worried. So that's when we contacted their office. And now they have my, you know, they have all these suspicion of charges. There's 5 of them, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't said what they're going to do.
Are they continuing to debrief?
It's finished. It was as of this weekend, it was finished. And they just have, you know, like, you know, it's like a cloud hanging over us waiting to see what's going to happen.
Well, what is their situation on, they say how, when they're going to let him out of the hospital, that type thing?
No, not at all. They haven't indicated that. They said they might let him out in a short period of time, and if he is let out, then he'll be held on legal hold until this thing is cleared up.
Mm-hmm.
And his counsel, the Marine Corps counsel, you know, is my brother's counsel, said it could possibly take as long as 3 months. And I don't understand it, you know, why it should take that long,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Did you find those telephone numbers that...
Yes, I mailed them to you.
Oh, did you?
Didn't you receive them?
No, I haven't received them yet.
Oh, gee, I sent them... Oh, they went out Friday. You should get them today or tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. I haven't received them yet.
I said, it was 3 numbers, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent them to you in the mail. Hold on, maybe I'm going to have a copy here.
Good.
Hold on.
Good.
I'm sorry, I brought the copy of the letter home.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have it yet. But I sent them to you confidential,
mm-hmm.
No, personal confidential.
Right.
And they'll mail Friday. I guess they wouldn't get there till tomorrow.
Yeah, they may get here this afternoon, but it depends on what the postal workers did over the weekend. But if they worked weekend, then it could be here and so forth. But I haven't received them yet. Could be in the afternoon mail, which is not in yet.
See, Wednesday, I didn't get over to my mother's house, you know, because I got home late that evening. I didn't get over to my mother's house to get the numbers, and
right.
I got them Thursday, and first thing Friday morning, I got them out in the mail.
Do you feel that your brother is in position or wants to make a statement that would be different from what he made in Sweden and elsewhere before he got here?
What type of statement?
I mean, the fact that he made the previous statements under duress and so forth.
Oh, sure, he was, you know...
Has he so told the Marine Corps on this? Has he told them that he would be interested in doing that?
I don't know. See, the lawyer has more or less handled this. And, you know, he's told us, he's instructed my brother and all of us not to say anything at all to the media. You know, not to discuss it with
right.
anybody.
Mr. Sweeney, hold on just a minute.
Sure.
I've got another call I've got to take. Hold on.
Sure.
Thank you. Hello, Tom. That 500 letters are going to hit tonight from the POWs. How's it going for you there? Oh, really? Where are you staying in case we need you? Right. Right. And Ramada Inn in Lawrence? Okay. Very good. Right. Beautiful. Anything I can do for you on this end? Very good. I know one thing I wanted to mention. What are we? What does this cover letter to Eileen Engel need to say over Ross's signature? The POW campaign, wishing them well in the POW campaign. All right. Secondly, have you talked with Mrs. Howes in Wichita, Kansas about Doug Hegdahl? Haven't spoken to Jerry Sellers since you and I last talked. Okay, Ross has some thoughts on that, and I'll just proceed with the other. Okay, I think that does it. Good to talk with you, and take care. Okay, John.
Mr. Sweeney, I'm sorry I had to leave the line.
That's quite all right.
What is your home phone number in case I need to reach you? I may get into New York tonight, or it may be tomorrow.
Right, my home phone number is area code 5. What I wanted to say is, I told my brother about our conversation and everything, and he was delighted.
Good.
He really was. He said, made him feel much better, that you had been familiar with other prisoners that, had gone through the same types of things.
Right.
He really felt good about that.
Mm-hmm.
But this thing about, you just mentioned about a statement, that's been bothering me too, I don't know if this has ever been conveyed to the Marine Corps, but as you know, the lawyers we have sort of like take charge and,
Well, it might be wise that you tell your brother and not leave all of this to the attorneys, because after all, it's his life they're dealing with, and his career and so forth, and I think it might be incumbent upon you as his brother.
Yeah.
If he feels it. Now, if he doesn't feel like making a statement and disclaiming having made the statements in North Vietnam while under duress, then, of course, he shouldn't.
Well, no, this
Whatever
is
he does,
this is what he wanted to do right away when he read the papers. He wanted to start calling people up, and, we had to stop him.
Right.
He says, as I told you, when he first came back and read this defective nonsense in the paper, he almost jumped through the window.
Right.
Because he never even thought that, It just never occurred to him that people wouldn't know what was going on.
Good. Now, since they are through with their debriefing,
yeah.
Is he still off limits to anyone else? Can anyone else see him? Could I see him, or is it
still? You could see him.
I could see him.
Because I know some of my relatives were in to see him yesterday.
Very good, then.
And,
maybe we can take off tomorrow afternoon or Wednesday and go out and visit with him.
Yeah, he's not allowed out of the hospital, but
No. We could go there, though. Go to the hospital and visit with him there, right?
Oh, sure.
Good.
There's definitely no problem.
Mr. Sweeney, I'll be talking with you when I get to New York.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
One other thing.
Yes.
I did ask him, of course, you asked me about did they take him to see museums.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I didn't think so. I asked about it, that. He said, yes, right before he left, they took him out to a couple of, like museums
right.
and things.
Very good.
So, but he, as I said, he knows more of what happened than I do, and
right.
he probably can tell you a heck of a lot more.
But very good.
He'd be delighted to meet with you. I know he will.
Well, I look forward to seeing you.
Oh, good. I'm
thank
not telling
you,
that to me.
We'll be talking with you later.
Very good.
Goodbye. Now.
Bye-bye.
More people. The more the people, the more they buy. And the more our store is able to charge you less. Top value stamps help keep our prices down.
At Kroger, we give top value stamps because they help keep our prices down. Channel 8 News on the move at 10.
This is Lieutenant Colonel James Lindbergh Hughes. Injured when his plane was shot down He has been a prisoner of war in North Vietnam for more than 3 years. His wife and two children live in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
I'm Mrs. James Lindbergh Hughes, and this is supposed to be the voice of my husband. He went to Vietnam almost 4 years ago, and he's still there. Peter was 7 years old when he left, and Daria was 10. Peter's 10 now, and Daria's 13. My husband has been there 3.5 years, and we haven't heard from him in 2 years.
Now, the American Adventure. The people and events shaping our lives and our time now. This week, POW, Next of Kin, the story of the casualties of the war in Vietnam, the wives, the families, and the men, with ABC News correspondents Edward P. Morgan and Roger Peterson in just a moment. Now is brought to you by Century Insurance, made to order for your home, your family, your business. Century Insurance, made to order for you.
Good evening. I'm John Jonas, president of Century Insurance. I wanted to take this minute to tell you how pleased Century is to have been able to bring you several programs in this distinguished series. Tonight's program, Prisoners of War, is a subject so very important to all of us and so terribly personal to some that Century Insurance has contributed its commercial time so that you may see the program uninterrupted. We at Century, myself, our thousands of employees, and the 500,000 policyholders who own Century Insurance believe American business has a responsibility in its television advertising. A responsibility to support and present important and meaningful programs like this. Thank you.
Every war produces the agonies of the innocent. In Vietnam, civilians have died and suffered on both sides. The Pentagon lists nearly 1,600 Americans in the Indochina theater missing in action or prisoners of war, mostly shot down from the air. This has produced a group of unique casualties on the home front, the wives and families of the prisoners and missing men, whose fate to them has become a separate issue. Hanoi plays a torture game of cat and mouse with these Americans. Without explanation, it has released a few. The fate of others is unclear. How to pierce this dreadful void? Hanoi is guilty of defying the Geneva Convention for treatment of war prisoners. The enemy retorts America is guilty of war crimes. It notes the fact that we have dropped more bombs on Indochina than the total tonnage dropped by the U.S. in all theaters of World War II. But to the families of the missing and captured men, the issue is very simple and very personal. They want them back, and meanwhile they want to know whether they are alive. The women, trying to fight off bitterness and despair, have become a kind of flying squad of stubborn hope, drawing strength from each other as these wives gather together in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
This weekend, a very important event took place in our family house. One of our sons was married. And we had close friends, that my husband and I have had for years, plus, of course, my son's friends there. And every heart and mind was filled with one thing: how sad that his father couldn't have been there. But these events must take place. Children grow up, they have their confirmations, their Holy Communions, their marriages, graduations, and Daddy's not there. And now they marry and move away from home, and he's missed all the high school and college years.
Now, the most difficult thing to me is, and I want to impress it upon all people, and that is, it's like a kidnapping when a man is a prisoner of war or missing in action and we hear nothing. Now, if you've read of kidnappings or if you've never had that experience, this is it.
It's very hard not to know. I mean, some days I plan a lot of things for when he will come back, and then I think, well, you know, now wait a minute, you don't know. And this makes it doubly difficult, I think, trying to keep yourself on an even keel. It's almost impossible, really.
I know I have tried not to become bitter about this whole situation, but I am afraid I am becoming extremely bitter because I do not feel that all of the effort is being made by every individual in this country that should be made. I feel that our men have given and sacrificed for this cause. And I feel that every effort, every single individual in this country is responsible for these men. They were fighting for a cause that this country believed in, whether it is not believed in now or not. These men should be important. Let us not become like North Vietnam and not care about our prisoners.
If you have a time limit, you can adjust to that, but it's just this endless period. I was told by a very good friend of Bill's, right after he was shot down, he said, Janie, he said, be prepared for the washer and dryer to break down and think in terms of a couple, 3 years. I wanted to throw him out of my house that day, but it's turned out to be 5 years. And I think, you know, it's just this endless time for them, the concern how these men are mentally and physically. They'd be shells when they come home. Then it's the thought of when they do come home, what will they be like? What will they have to go through?
I think one thing that is, of course, so difficult for all of us is the vision we have of our husbands.
That's right. I was when this first happened, for 6 months at a time, like this happened in early spring, and I thought, by the end of summer, Buzz will be home. He'll be home. And then the summer would come, and I'd say, oh, Christmas. Christmas, he'll be home, I'll hear from him Christmas, and then summer again, and this went on. But then after a while, I reached the point that I couldn't make myself believe this any longer, because I was just fooling myself. I was living, you know, 6 months at a time, and then it would end, and now I can't do this.
Well, I have seven children, ranging in age now from 23 to down to 6. I think, considering the circumstances, they've responded heroically. But four teenage boys certainly need the guidance of a father. And a little girl who's 18 months old when her father leaves, and now almost 7, really has had a terrible void in her life. Can you imagine what it's like to have a little 3-year-old go up to a stranger in uniform and say, are you my daddy? It's had a tremendous effect on my children, but how much? What effect? Who knows? I think that story will be told in the future. It's all a part of their development and their character. I've done the best I can as a mother, but I really can't be a mother and a father.
In Fort Worth, wives organized a letter-writing campaign to Hanoi. Texas industrialist Ross Perot, who failed to get to Hanoi on his own campaign, describes this new effort to ABC's Roger Peterson.
We wanted to organize, find out what it took to organize an entire city to express concern for these men over an extended period of time. We chose Fort Worth, Texas. The people of Fort Worth have taken this responsibility completely upon themselves. The newspapers, radio stations, television stations, civic organizations, the colleges, the high schools, the adult organizations, the children's organizations have all focused the attention of their organizations in the entire city on these men. It's my understanding that we've reached approximately 100,000 letters in Fort Worth, Texas. I would say that the campaign there has been an excellent success. The big thing we get from that campaign, other than, of course, the message to Hanoi that Fort Worth is deeply concerned over a very small number of families from the Fort Worth area. See, that, again, will be a paradox to them. A whole city, a small number of families. We've learned how to organize a city, and we can mass produce that. If we have to, we'll organize cities all over the country. to express visible concern over extended periods of time to bring the release of these men.
Each one of you, we're delighted you're here today. The pilot Fort Worth release, Hanoi release the prisoners project gains momentum. We're told that so far 110,000 letters have been received from Fort Worth destined to Hanoi. Today we're privileged to have a continuing part in this gaining momentum of the United We Stand program. We're particularly privileged today to hear from Mrs. Michelle Jones. Michelle is of Fort Worth, and her husband is U.S. Air Force Captain Bill Jones, also of Fort Worth, who's been missing in action for 2.5 years. Michelle, we're glad you're with us today. We want to hear from you. Would you come, please?
I'm not here as a part of a military organization, a political organization, or from the media. I'm speaking to you today because I care so very much about a person who is very beautiful to me. I'm speaking about my husband, Bill Jones, a Fort Worth boy. Bill was shot down over 2.5 years ago, and from that time I have had no word from him. He is listed as missing in action, and we hope to God that he is a prisoner. A lot of people have said to me, don't you wish he were rather dead than a prisoner? No, I don't. I want him home. But let me tell you about the conditions that these prisoners...
In Washington, Vice President Agnew talked with Correspondent Peterson about the Return the Prisoners of War campaign.
Do you think that this public pressure will do any good, or has it done any good?
I think it'll do a tremendous amount of good, because the propriety of the question is with us, and the improprieties that are being committed by them are simply indefensible. Consequently, a nation very conscious of its public image, such as this small country, this very hostile, belligerent country is, when faced with the kind of opinion that's coming out of the rest of the world, will probably make some modifications.
Sir, do you see any solution at all to get these men released, or at least find out who's alive and who's dead?
Certainly, we have to keep working every minute on it. I don't see a lot of optimism showing on the horizon simply because the enemy treats this question so casually. They've even said in response to our questions, well, you only have 1,550 men that are missing or prisoners of war. Now, why are you so concerned about 1,550 men? They don't treat human life with the same dignity we do. And until we can bring about this pressure I refer to, that's the key. Not their humane instincts, because they haven't, the ruling powers in North Vietnam have not exhibited any humane instincts, but the pressure for them to look good in the eyes of the rest of the world is our best fighting device.
For whatever reason, Hanoi has released 9 prisoners of war. We talked with 2 of them and one who escaped, Major Nick Rowe. Rowe was a captive in South Vietnam for more than 5 years. Roger Peterson asked him about life in a tiger cage.
They try to create the impression that you're not being really tortured, you're being corrected for making a mistake. And in the case of being recaptured after an attempt to escape, I went into a 6 or 7 day period in which I was placed in leg irons and arm irons. I was stretched between them. It's like being on a rack. You're in this 24 hours a day while your muscle's not up. You can't come out. You're not released. I had dysentery, and I was forced to lay in it the whole period of time. You get 2 meals a day if you can eat them. It's rice and salt and no water. And this is as long as you can last, until finally they get you to the point that you'll tell them that you're sorry and you confess a crime in trying to escape, and tell them that you're not going to try to do it again.
Would you get in the cage and show me?
No, I will not. I've been in this cage, and I'm not going in it again.
Why not?
The cage represents a period of time in my life that I don't particularly care to remember, other than remembering it to perhaps clarify what it's like to people who can't be there. Thank God they can't be there. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm not going any closer to it than I have to.
I don't know how I can relate what it's really like to be kept in a 10-by-10 cell that's a brick, has a galvanized tin roof. It heats up to 130 in the day. You're covered from head to foot with heat rays 6 months out of the year.
Navy Lieutenant Frischmann was returned by Hanoi after almost 2 years imprisonment.
You can't talk or relate to other people. You, in your own mind, doubt even your own sanity. You say to yourself that, you know you're in a communist prison camp. You know they're throwing this brainwashing stuff at you. And you ask yourself, am I brainwashed? And if I was, would I know it? And since you can't talk with anyone, discuss these problems, in your own mind, you really don't know.
What about the guys who are still there? How is this going to affect them? How many of those men do you think will come out alive?
That's real hard to tell how many men will come out. The 1,600 men are listed as missing in action, prisoner of war. Over 400 who have been confirmed prisoners of war. I sure hope there are a lot more. As the years go on, though, how can a person really stand up to those intolerable situations? A couple of years, maybe. Some people have been there for six, though. I don't know how much longer they can last, really.
I got over the fear of my life because I realized that I was being protected by the militia, the guards that captured me and took charge. However, there were civilians in the area that wanted to punish me, I guess.
Air Force Major Joe Carpenter remembers how it was for him.
I fear to think what would have happened if the guards hadn't have been there to protect me. So I overcame that, but I still feared the things that might come later. And I had a sample of this about 2 hours later when we were taken through a village, and some of the villagers did get their hands on us. And the worst thing I can describe, actually, is the fact that I had a mustache, and they pulled that mustache. It felt like someone were putting all their weight on it, and that kind of watered my eyes. But I lived through it, and after that, it wasn't quite as bad.
You were in...
The main thing that, the hardest thing, really, was the isolation, just the... getting used to being by yourself all the time and living in a solitary environment. The thing I had going for me was that I wasn't interrogated immediately after being shot down. Another thing that I believe helped me a great deal was the contact that I experienced with the local population, with the kids in particular. As they came by and looked at me in this bunker that I was kept in, daily, almost constantly, I started making faces and trying to develop a little rapport or something there, a little communication with them, and I found that I could make them laugh and giggle, and pretty soon the older people gathered around and looked at me in the same way. And all of a sudden, I suppose, they changed their attitude toward me, whereas they had thought of me as just a guy who had been bombing them, as, well, this guy's a human. And a little cross-cultural exchange there, if you will, maybe a little more understanding.
Did your attitude change any towards the Vietnamese, seeing them face to face?
Well, I'm sure it did with the people. I realized, too, that they were people living there. And I don't know how my attitude changed, but going through an experience like that, it has to change. There's no way.
Secretary Laird did say last December there would be no sizable withdrawal until it was negotiated. What did he mean by sizable?
And what assurance do we have that all the troops are not going to be pulled out and this group of men are going to be left stranded?
The wives of the men asked difficult and pointed questions. In San Diego, the Pentagon's Richard Capon tries hard to field them.
That, among other things, that the prisoner of war question should be considered separate from all of these other aspects of the war itself.
Because it's something that grows worse every single day. Those men are in worse condition as each day goes by. Or maybe my husband's been dead one more day since he was shot down. I don't think people comprehend that every day means so very much.
Ambassador Averill Harriman sat across the table from the men from Hanoi in Paris and was directly involved in trying to find a solution to the prisoner of war problem.
Naturally, having worked so long over the problems of our prisoners of war, I feel the subject very deeply. I feel we have an obligation to our men that have fought so bravely to see that they are as well treated as we possibly can, see that they come home early. And this is one of the reasons why I'm so strongly for a negotiated settlement, why I feel that victimization of the war is not going to achieve what we want. We want our prisoners and our men home, and we want to end the fighting and not the continuation of fighting. We have an obligation to. We've been involved in escalating this war, and now we have an obligation to see that it's brought to a conclusion.
General Chappie James flew 101 missions during the Korean War, 78 missions in Vietnam. A protege of the great air ace Robin Olds, he's now the man at the Pentagon responsible for finding the answers to the prisoner of war problem.
Some of the girls who hadn't gotten any letters at all have gotten one or two. But the fact here is that people, when they go on trying and trying and nothing happens, they have a tendency to give up. We've got to continue to try. We can't possibly stop, because those guys that are sitting up there are depending on us continuing to hammer away with everything that we possibly can. And that one little drop might hit the right spot later, and they'll come roaring home, and this is what we're hoping for.
Do they believe that you're really trying everything?
No, they don't. And the reactions run the gamut of emotion from being grateful to being just downright mad, and you're the most easiest thing at hand. And they say, if somebody ever tells me that we'll never forget those wonderful men, I'll spit in his eye. And sometimes they break down in tears, and they say, don't tell me what the government is doing. Don't tell me how many people were rescued. Mine wasn't, and I want to know from you, General, where is my husband and what are you doing about it? At the end of these sessions, they usually, there's the usual apologies and say, well, I'm sorry, I was upset, and it made me feel better to be able to talk to you like that. Well, if it makes them feel better, then it's worth the effort for me. Because you see, a lot of people go around saying, I know how they feel, but I know they really don't know how they feel. I know that I don't know. You know, I've had the same thing. I had 50 years of experience of being black, and I've had people on occasion who would come to me and say, after a very disturbing incident of a racial nature, would come to me and say, Chappie, I know how you feel. And I'd look at them, and if they're not black, I know they really don't know how I feel. They think they do, and they'd like to know, and they'd like to help. And it's sincere, but they really don't. So I try not to make that mistake when I'm talking with the wise. I know that they are in extreme anguish, something I could never experience because I don't have a husband or a father or the father of my kids over there and trying to bring up a brood without them. But I try to furnish them with as much information and as much help as I can, and I keep trying to understand, and I keep trying to solve the problem for them. And that's my mission in life right now.
Perhaps, as General James said, only a wife really knows how it feels. For Diane Campbell of Louisiana, it's like this.
I did receive two letters after they told me he'd been shot down. One the day they told me and one the following Monday.
It had been written before he went up?
Yes, the day before he was shot down. And they were cheerful letters, short, brief type letters. He was going on alert the next day and didn't have time to write much, but he did write nice letters. So there was nothing to give me the feeling that he might have thought something was going to happen to him.
Well, what do you believe inside? Do you feel that he's alive?
Oh, I don't think a wife ever lets her husband die. I guess I've made him immortal a little bit. I don't feel that he's dead.
Is that vary from day to day or just instead?
Yes, it does vary. There are times when I wake up in the morning feeling that he's not coming back, but I think deep inside, I always feel that he's alive.
Now, you're going out, you're trying to stir up the public. What are you doing?
Yes, we make speeches to anyone who will listen to us. Deanna has her own little thing about that. I was getting ready to go out of town one day to make a speech, and she came and asked me where we were going, and I told her. She said, "Are you going to speech my daddy home?" So, I think that's a rather unique way of putting it.
Are you able to hide your emotions from the children? Do you have to hide them?
No. I'm not sure I would be able to, although I tried at first. I really don't have to because the children know that their daddy was shot down. And they understand probably better than I do. Children accept things so easily. There have been times when I've been a little down in the dumps and one of them has caught me, but they seem to understand that sometimes big girls have their moments too.
How do they react?
Well, Deanna usually says mommies have to cry too when they miss their daddy. So she knows. She understands.
We no longer need General Sherman to remind us that war is hell. Its inferno in Vietnam has been pouring from the tube into the safe comfort of our living rooms for years. Its savagery is signaled by My Lai, by South Vietnam's tiger cages, by the treatment of the men you heard described on this program, and by the suffering of these American women who do not even know whether they are widows. The prisoner issue is entangled in a numbers game. Hanoi finally has listed, at least partially, the names of U.S. prisoners held in the North. The fate of those missing in the South or Laos is unknown. Washington maintains that Hanoi's lists are incomplete and further demands an accounting of men missing in action who may actually be held by Hanoi and not just lost in the awful limbo of this strange war. Who is to blame for this cruel, beclouded dilemma? Can we retrieve these brave men? How? Will the efforts of wives and families and others in the Right Hanoi campaign have any effect? The Pentagon cautiously hopes so, though belligerents seldom release prisoners before the fighting stops. Nobody has any firm answers to these jagged questions, but they form another part of this tormented conflict, a tragic byproduct of battle, which has not been run through anybody's computer. This is Edward P. Morgan. Good night.
Century Insurance is proud to have presented this program to you tonight. And frankly, we're pleased that Century has grown large enough to be able to sponsor a network series like this. Today, we're international in scope and one of the best known names in the insurance industry. And Century continues to grow simply by offering you something you need, insurance protection that's made to order for you. Thank you and good night.
Now has been brought to you by Century Inflation Guard Life Insurance. Like all protection from Century, made to order for you.
It's very difficult to raise a family without a father around and to explain to the children why their dad cannot be with them.
It would be 4 years in October. We had not heard, not one line from our son.
How difficult it is to explain as he wakes up at night and cries that he misses his daddy, what the words missing in action really mean. It's been extremely difficult for two little girls to understand that maybe their daddy's dead and maybe he's alive. I feel like screaming, "He's mine. Tell me what's happened to him."
All I have is one simple question. Is my husband alive?
LBJ talks to Texas Democrats in convention tonight.
And a brand new tropical storm has cropped up in the Gulf of Mexico.